Welcome to the Cello Sherpa podcast, where we explore all aspects of the climb to the summit from intermediate musician to the professional stage. Check us out online at thecellosherpa.com or follow us on Instagram or Threads at thecellosherpa. I'm Joel Dallow, your host. I joined the cello section of the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra in 1999 and founded the Riverside Chamber Players based in Roswell, Georgia in 2003. If you're looking for a bit of extra help on learning your orchestra or solo repertoire, perhaps we can help. Visit www.thecellosherpa.com and drop us a line. We offer virtual or in-person lessons. Today's episode is sponsored by Clear Resources, your premier resource for compliance, legal, ethics, and risk. For more information, visit them online at clearresources.com. Today's guest is cellist Austin Huntington. He was appointed principal cellist of the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra in 2015 at the age of 20, which makes him one of the youngest principal musicians in a major American orchestra. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Cello Sherpa podcast.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
So tell us a little bit about your background. Do you come from a musical family?
Actually, no. All my family's in medicine, so I'm the one lone black sheep still playing music. My older brother used to play violin. He still plays every once in a while, but he was at Colburn with me. He's a year and a half older than me. But besides that, dad's a ER doctor. My mom's a retired registered nurse. And then now both my brothers are in med school, actually right downtown Indianapolis as well. So I feel like if I didn't go into something music, I feel like maybe I'd be a veterinarian because I have a cute dog. But something to do with medicine, because that's the way the rest of my family went.
So how did you end up getting on this music track if everybody else is in medicine?
So it's one of those where it's kind of like a game of telephone / grasshopper, where my older brother started playing violin when he was about 4, and I was maybe 2.5 or 3 at the time. And obviously, when you have a sibling that close, you are very imbued with sibling rivalry. Mm-hmm. And so my parents, even though they didn't play music professionally, you know, being medical professionals, they still wanted to cultivate a love of the arts. And so we went to a lot of symphony concerts. I remember we went to Grand Rapids Symphony, Battle Creek Symphony. We lived in Michigan at the time. And so I remember my brother had just started playing violin. I saw a double bass lying on its side at one of these concerts. And then I pointed to it and said, I want to play that. And obviously, looking back, it was because my brother played the violin, which, you know, is like that big when you're that old. And I just wanted to find the biggest version of that so I could be even better than him. And then my parents, very sneakily, from what I assume this is their tactic, they convinced me in some way that a bass was basically a big cello. And they're like, why don't you just play this one instead? It's still a big instrument. It's like, okay, sure. So then I started playing. I was one of those kids where when I was young, I feel like most kids, I hated practicing. Honestly, you know, you never really grew up, still hate practicing.
Yeah.
But no, it's one of those where, you know, up until I was the age of 10, my brother was the skilled prodigy. We moved to South Bend, Indiana. And so he played with Sopin Symphony, won all these competitions. And finally, it was when I started with my high school teacher who was in the Chicago Symphony that I finally kicked it into gear. And, you know, the tides started to turn on which one of the brothers started to win the competitions. And I felt pretty decent about it. So then went to Proman music program when I was 14. We were also there together. And I started studying with Ron Leonard there. And after my first year, I was preparing for the Rostropovich competition in 2009. After my first year there, I just knew that I wanted my life to look like his life when I was his age. Back then, I think he was like 72, 75 or so. But I remember I was thinking, when I'm 75, I want to look back on my life and have it be just like him because he was such an inspiring role model. Fast forward a few years later, got into Colburn. I studied with him for 4 years, and I do a festival out in San Diego called Mainly Mozart. And every time I'm out there, the hotel that we stay at is 10 minutes away from the retirement community that he lives in. So I go play for him. I get lunch with him and still keep up with him at least once or twice a year. So it's...
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's really...
How's he doing?
He's great. He retired recently from Colburn in the past few years because he's had some medical things, but if you didn't know about that, you wouldn't ever second guess it. He's doing super well. He still plays recitals, and he's going to be 90 this month.
Wow.
Actually, next month. But He's 90. His recital consisted of Boccherini A Major Sonata, which for cellists, you know, that is not something that you want to willingly choose. And then Beethoven Fourth Sonata, Rochberg Ricordanza, and then the first one of Brahms Piano Trio. And he still has a sense of humor because he was saying he was rehearsing with these musicians who they were fantastic musicians, but he said that their playing was a lot better than their talking. And so he has to use hearing aids for when he talks, but when he plays, he can still hear all the resonances and everything. So he just leaves his hearing aids out because the playing is fine without them, and he didn't want to listen to them anyways. So still has that like cutting edge, sharp knife of humor. So
that's funny. Yeah. So you were 4 then when you started?
I was, yes. So okay. It's been 25 years of absolute joy, I guess.
With some pain and suffering, I'm sure, in there, right?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. That's the main part of it. The joy is just like the little sprinkles on top.
Okay, so you have a bachelor's of music from mm-hmm. Colburn
yes.
and a master's from Indiana. Mm-hmm. How did you get 6 years worth of music degrees and win your first job at 20? Did you go to college at 14? What was...
I wish. Actually, I was, my older brother went to college when he was that age because he was way too smart for his own good. No, I'm just normal. I won the job my 3rd year of Colburn. So at the end of the 3rd year. So I worked it out. And it was the way that Colburn's, at least back when I was there, the way that Colburn's academics were set up is the 4th year is particularly light. They heavily load the first 3 years. So in your 4th year, you basically have 1 semester full of classes. The 2nd semester, you only have 1 class in addition to orchestra and chamber music, because they purposely want to give you that time to take auditions, to take, whether that's for masters, for orchestra, or whatever, to explore what you want. And so I was able to convince them to let me move that 1 class to the 1st semester. So I flew back and forth for 3 or 4 concerts that 1st semester, then started in January 2016 full time, and then was then able to convince them to let me take an unpaid week to go walk the stage for graduation. The masters came during COVID because Indianapolis, we were unfortunately at the front of the pack in terms of who stopped paying their musicians first, and also may or may not have cut off some healthcare. So I was coming up with a lot of contingency plans in terms of what do I do. I'm also one of those people where if I sit around to do nothing, I go crazy. So I texted Eric Kim, one of the cello teachers. I didn't study with him at ASMA, but we were stamp partners in the festival orchestra together. And so I texted him, and just off the blue, I was just like, would you happen to have space in your studio for a master's application for a master's student? I want to say this was in June, so well past the date of when I should have applied, because this was right when we were beginning to get furloughed in June 2020. And so then he texted back immediately and was just like, absolutely, let me know what I can do to help. And to his credit, he made the whole process the simplest I've ever had it in terms of applying. So then in the fall, I started as a master's student. I moved down to Bloomington. Ironically, what ended up happening is I did a 3-semester master. So fall 2020, spring 2021, fall 2021. We started playing concerts again in fall 2021. I moved down to Bloomington when we started. All the classes were online, so didn't really need to be there. I could have just kept my apartment in Indianapolis.
Yeah.
So then when fall 2021 came around, we started playing concerts again and going back to a full schedule. And for the life of me, I can't figure out why, but I still had to go back down to Bloomington to get my orchestra credit.
Oh, geez.
Which was ironic because I had to take time off of the ISO to go get my orchestra credit with Bloomington. Anyway, it's a whole thing. So basically, that was also the time when I was preparing for the San Francisco audition. So I was having like 3 or 4 lessons with him every week. And he was absolutely fantastic. But then it was one of those where, you know, I was now in Indianapolis, and then like 3 or 4 times a week had to commute back down to Bloomington. So I was always in the wrong place. But luckily, I was able to graduate with a master's and a outside area of social work. So it was master's of cello performance outside area of social work, just because I wanted to see if I could kind of marry the two. Because also, like, when you go through a pandemic and your whole family's in medicine and you're a musician, especially when you're not playing, you feel relatively useless and hopeless a lot of the time. And so I saw a lot of the mental health struggles, the substance abuse struggles, a lot of the stuff that kind of the darker parts of humanity that came out during the pandemic, especially as everybody was stuck at home together. And so I wanted to see if I could use music to enhance or help the other areas. And so far, I'm sad to say it's been so busy that I haven't been able to institute any projects to merge the two. But it's definitely a goal of mine in the future to do something with the both of those.
And what was that like then to try and add classes for social work to your study of music?
It actually wasn't that bad. I think it only involved one extra class outside of what I would have normally had to take, because all of the humanities that we needed two classes. And I think the outside area was just one extra class. So I used my two humanities classes to do, I did intro to substance abuse counseling and domestic violence counseling, as well as mental health counseling. And so they're very like introductory level classes. I don't want to pretend to be an expert at any one of those, but it gave me a better understanding of what a lot of these people were going through and how best to help them. And so it was tricky during the COVID year, because when you're dealing with such sensitive issues, having class online is not the way to do it.
Yeah.
It's especially with those kinds of issues, especially with the counseling side of things, like that person-to-person connection is incredibly important. And I think that was one of the first things to get lost during the online classes. So it was tricky, but from the actual class load point, it was just, I think, one extra class, so not too bad.
Yeah, and good for you for thinking outside of how we use our profession. Because I think a lot of times it's really easy to become focused on ourselves and what we're doing and just continuing to try and get better. And it's harder to look outside that, but to be able to put those two things together, I think that's pretty noble.
Oh, thank you.
Use that together. I'm curious then, personally, I think that if you have a major symphony job and you go get a master's, they probably should waive the orchestra requirement. But I know that Indiana is not the only school that would continue to insist and probably really enjoyed having you in orchestra, which is part of why they wanted you there. In that first semester that Indy went back, so fall of 21, did you have to do, other than orchestra, did you have to do other in-person classes too, or were you able to do everything else online?
So I specifically chose classes that were online for that semester just so I wouldn't have to, I could be a little bit more condensed in how I came down. And so like I was saying, the lessons that I took were primarily front-loaded before that orchestra audition that I was taking. And so the way that Eric and I worked it out, we did like three or four lessons a week, and then we would go after that audition. We would have a lesson when we would have time. But besides that, if I had like 4 weeks of orchestra, we just wouldn't have a lesson for 4 weeks. And we'd still check in every once in a while and then schedule the next lesson. So we ended up with the exact number of lessons that were required. And so for orchestra, I was also able to potentially sweet talk the director of the orchestra. And he let me do Falstaff in the pit because I love opera with a passion. And I had played Falstaff already when I was in the Verbier Festival Orchestra in 2016. And so I played it. The lead was Bryn Terfel back then, who was one of my favorite singers.
Oh, wow.
So I had nothing but, and there's this really cool moment, not to like get completely sidetracked, but it was one of like the coolest moments of my career so far, even though it was like right after I actually started a career. Bryn Terfel, there's this moment in Falstaff where I can't remember what he's talking about, but there's this one little pizzicato duet. So the principal cellist has a pizzicato and it's mimicked by what he does. And so he usually just like stands across the room, like reading from the book during the rehearsals. During the concert, I feel this hand on my shoulder and he basically whisper sings the pizzicato solo that we have together in my ear as we're playing it. And I just remember that was just like, ah, this is why I do it. Like one of my idols, we just got to like play within like 6 inches of each other. And you also realize his intonation is impeccable, no matter how close
he's amazing. So that was at Verbier.
That was at Verbier.
Okay.
Yeah. So sorry, that was a long sequitur into the fact I was wanting to do that. Obviously, when you're in a pit, if somebody puts their hand on your shoulder and whispers something in the ear, it's probably that you're getting fired or something. But yeah, so I was able to play the Verdi Falstaff and then one other program, which was a really cool idea, which was Teddy Abrams, the conductor of the Louisville Symphony, came and conducted 4 services of rehearsals with no concert on Rite of Spring. And the point of this is to go through all the big, really difficult pieces for college orchestras that if you're called the next day to say, come and sub with the ISO, come and sub with Cleveland, whatever, that you know Rite of Spring, you've already played it kind of thing, instead of that being your first time playing. And so they were doing that with a lot of the big works kind of thing, and then being a little bit more experimental with the actual orchestra programming. And what Teddy Abrams wanted to do, which at first I was a little bit skeptical, but he told us the first day his goal was to play Rite of Spring without a conductor. And we all kind of laughed. And he's like, no, I'm serious. And we're like, oh, yeah, sure. So the last day comes around. We were woodshedding a lot of these places, making sure the transitions are clean. He's like, okay, let's begin. So he began and just didn't conduct. And at first, again, it was what the heck is going on? And then you started to realize how much better it became because people were paying attention. Granted, keep in mind, because of the timing, this was the fall 2021. The only schedule that I could do, it's a slightly different schedule now, but I did the freshman sophomore orchestra, like undergraduate. Mm-hmm. So these are people who are just like, oh, I have to show up to orchestra. I never want to play an orchestra. It's stupid. Why are we doing this kind of thing? So that's kind of the vibe of what was going on. And so people are making just stupid mistakes because they're not paying attention. They aren't listening. And so finally, when you're forced to listen and you're like, this is the last service, I have to know where my part fits and I have to know what my part sounds like. Everything just came together like that. And it was just amazing. Obviously, there were some transitions, like especially I remember the 11-4 bar, people just lost count and started playing like 13. So little things like that. It wasn't perfect, but we were all just like, holy crap. And then he basically, his point was like, even when you have a conductor, this is how you should be playing. I'm up here to facilitate certain things, like the parts, like the transitions. I'm here to facilitate that. But normally I can conduct and it's kind of like autopilot, unless there's something drastic that's going to happen or if something's pulling apart. You don't need me. You all are fantastic chamber musicians. So it was really cool. I like that.
I think that really pushes a lot of the conversation we've had on this podcast about how playing in orchestra is large scale chamber music.
Absolutely.
So if you really want to be good at playing an orchestra, play more chamber music, because especially without a conductor, you're forced to listen to what's happening around you. And that really sharpens those skills. What was it like though, to go back to school and play in a student orchestra after having a job compared to doing it before?
So I tried my very best. We were talking a little bit before we started recording about different leadership personality types. I'm definitely one of those where, like, when I'm sitting in the principal chair, I do my best to facilitate and be extroverted. I don't like to draw attention to myself if I don't need to. And when I go back to school, especially with, you know, how I was feeling, like I said before, about I wasn't feeling the best about where classical music was at the time during the point where, like, we all didn't really have anything to do. And so I wanted to do the best I can to fit in. I wanted to give the full experience of getting a master's. One of the reasons I got a master's is because one of my ideals of maybe once in the next 10 years or so, I want to teach at a major university. I want to become a teacher. I want to retire and not really retire, just retire to teaching. And a lot of these universities require masters. And I also wanted to, you know, keep learning. So I remember one of the first days back, what we did, we had sectionals for, they call it sectionals, but it was basically, we had the string sections and we had this giant projector. And so all the string players were in person with the conducting student. And then we'd have a coach on Zoom who had like one of those 360 degree camera things where they could see everything. They could zoom in on people kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And a couple of the people who were coaching us were like George Flizondas, Alex Carr, Ellen De Pasquale. For example, with Alex, I worked with him previously. And obviously we were still masked and I was trying to keep somewhat low profile. And so we were playing Tchaikovsky Serenade for Strings, and the concertmaster was doing her absolute best. She was a fantastic player, somewhat of a natural leader, but it seemed like she didn't really know exactly how to move to lead. And so I was trying my best to lead. I forgot who called it this, but it's called puppet leading. Mm-hmm. It's the kind of thing where you're helping them lead by showing them how to lead kind of thing. And so Alex stopped and he was just talking about, he was upset at the first violinist because nobody looked at their parts. And then he was concertmaster, watched the principal cellist. And then he just looked at the screen and was like, Austin, how's it going? And nobody besides the cello section, because obviously like I was in studio with a couple of the cellists and they knew, nobody else knew that I had a job or that basically the past. And so then he was just like, whatever happens, watch the principal cellist. He actually knows what he's doing kind of thing. I was like, do I now? So just little things that I would really cool. Eric was the teacher I studied with, Eric Kim, was absolutely fantastic in riding that fine line between the fact that I wanted to learn as much as I could. I wanted to learn from the other students. I wanted to learn from him, from everything. And so he was really great about treating me like an equal while still treating me like a student in the best way possible, where I still said that I had a lot to learn. And so little things like I would still play in studio class and I would get comments from the other students. I get comments from him like a normal person. And then if somebody was playing an orchestra audition in studio class, a mock audition, he would defer to me for comments first before he made his comments kind of thing, and encourage people to come and play for me as well. It was also a weird turnaround, but I know Rainer, the former principal of Atlanta, did this as well. Eric took a leave of absence this past year to work on other projects. And so we brought in guest teachers. And so I was able to teach for 3 weeks, which was really also odd because half of the studio were people that I was in studio with. So I was previously one of them. And now I'm telling them what to do. So it was a really cool thing. And it's, like I said, Eric was really fantastic at walking that fine line of making me feel special in the right ways in terms of I obviously had a lot more experience than other people in this class, but also understanding that I'm not there to show off. I'm there to learn just like everybody else kind of thing.
Yeah. And he was an early guest on this podcast. Mm. He's a really terrific teacher, one of the most in demand. So it was great to speak with him too. And I'm sure it was great to have you sort of as an asset to help with this whole process too. That must have been special.
I hope so. Yeah.
So 20 years old, you win the job. Was that your first audition?
No, that was my fourth audition. So my first audition, I remember each one, it kind of felt like a baby deer trying to stand for the first time. But once you learn how to stand, running is a lot easier kind of thing. That probably made absolutely no sense. I'm sorry for that. But basically, so my first audition was for Principal of Detroit Symphony. I had just turned 19 years old and I went on stage and I built myself up. I was like, I really want to be a principal cellist, all this fun stuff. And got on stage, played Dvorak. Didn't know how to like center myself, how to calm down. I didn't know anything about any performance technique, why auditions are different. So sat down, played first page of Dvorak, got to the end of the first page. I was all amped up and was like, yeah, it went well. And the committee was like, can we hear the second movement of Beethoven 5? And I was like, great. It's like, da, da, da. So my hands were shaking like crazy. I couldn't make a phrase to save my life. They cut me off after the one excerpt, obviously didn't advance. I always like to say the guy who won the job, he was the person right after me. And so I joked with him one time. We played again at Mainly Mozart together. And I joked with him, you know, I made you look good because of how bad I sounded. but he thought that was funny. Yeah, so basically went back to the hotel room and binge watched HGTV shows while eating Domino's for the rest of the day. It was pretty fantastic.
It's a good recovery.
Absolutely. And then I did one of the things that I learned the most from was doing a section of Houston and section of Cleveland within a week of each other, which was an absolutely horrible decision. Not because either of them was a bad audition, just because if anybody's taken Cleveland auditions before, they know they ask for really weird stuff. Like we did, for example, one of the ones was like Mauve Lost, but like not the Moldau, like other movements from it. So that I never played, for example, also Sprach before, and that was the first one. They had a bunch of Wagner stuff as well. And so the lists were very different, and I made the mistake of doing two very different auditions, basically a week apart. And so I basically burnt myself out practicing. I think it was the way that I did it was a 2-day rotation of excerpts, and each day was 7 to 8 hours of practice just to get everything down. That also led to tendinitis. It was just not a good time. So then I took a few months off, and then Indianapolis posted their job, and I was just like, I've seen them play before. It's one of those where you never get to choose where you land your first job. It gets a little bit better once you land your first job. You can be more selective with the auditions you take. But this one came up. I was like, my family is 2 hours north. This is amazing. I would love to do this. So I really got down to it. I worked with Mr. Leonard at the time about coming up with a good sustainable practice schedule, focusing a lot more on, instead of treating each one like a Dvorak concerto, for example, treating each one like an important, let's say he used this analogy one time, this one excerpt needs to be, for example, like the screw that goes in to hold a door together. It needs to be technically perfect, flawless, but also individually very beautiful kind of thing. Who knows what he actually meant by that. But it was one of those where it was just like, you need to approach it much more like a gymnast with a routine rather than a figure skater who focuses just on emotions. It's a lot more technically based. And so did that audition, or signed up for the audition, slept past my first flight, frantically called the personnel manager. I was like, I don't know what to do. I'm so sorry. And they're like, don't worry. Just if you can get a flight here, we'll just put you last on the second day of prelims. And then keep in mind, in every audition up to this, I had not advanced past the prelims. Okay. I finally had felt like I knew what I was doing with auditions. I felt confident. I felt relaxed. Other thing is, I never played really mocks for anybody. Before ISO, I played a mock for everybody every single day, or a different person every single day. So I showed up to the audition. The excerpts they chose in the first round were excerpts There were a couple in the middle that I wasn't super comfortable with, but it ended with Shostakovich 15, which was one of my strongest excerpts. Mm-hmm. And so I finished and I was just like, started to go into post-mortem mode. Oh, I think I missed this shift. I don't know if this came across. And then I got pulled aside by the personnel manager and they were just like, look, we're going to tell the other person they advanced in a sec, but you were just advanced straight to the finals. Mm. I was like, I'm sorry. Do you have the right number? So then I advanced to the finals and came back a couple months later. The first one was in March. Final round was in June. Came back a couple months later, was offered trials, did Beethoven 9 and Mahler 5 as my trials, which it doesn't get any better than that.
Yeah.
And that was back in 2015. And I've been tricking them into liking me ever since.
Well, and so did you feel that you had leadership experience, or how did you go about learning the skills that you needed to sit there? And what skills would you say it takes to make a great leader?
Sure. So my position was somewhat unique in that I was by far the youngest member of the orchestra. I was also by far the youngest member of the cello section. The next youngest person was in their mid-50s and everybody else was into their 60s. It was a relatively older cello section just because back in the 70s and 80s and 90s, they'd all hired around at the same time and they were all about the same age. So everybody, I would say out of an 8-person section, 6 of them were within 2 years of each other. And so basically all these people have combined decades into even really a century more of experience than I do. I'm this little kid who comes in and basically is supposed to tell people what to do, supposed to lead a section. The most leadership I've had before that was I wasn't even principal in Aspen. Like I said, I sat with Eric and Brinton and Dez. Even that, I didn't have leadership experience for there. I was principal of Colburn Orchestra, Chicago Youth Symphony, but that doesn't really mean anything. Those are basically youth symphonies. And so I remember one of the biggest learning experiences was we were playing Indiana Jones. It's one of the chase scenes from Indiana Jones, but it has the same rhythm over and over again. And I looked at the part, and this was, I played the summer season before I actually started. And I looked over at the part, and I was like, there's a better bowing for this. I know there's a better bowing because this is so awkward. So I went through and I was like, this is the great bowing. This is the most efficient bowing I can possibly have. I showed up to the first rehearsal and one of my dearest friends in the section, she's since retired, she speaks up very clearly and said, who the hell changed our bowings? Because little did I know, the ISO has a unique relationship with John Williams and a lot of the publishing houses. And so they proofed the music for the orchestral version of these Indiana Jones orchestra parts before they came out to the public. Oh. And these bowings had been in there ever since. So literally since the movie was released, they've been doing these bowings. And then I was like, I'm so sorry. So little things like that, or understanding that one of the biggest things with leadership I've learned, it's the old saying that, you know, we have 2 ears and 1 mouth kind of thing. It's not about telling people what to do. It's the difference between a boss and a leader, but learning from different people's life experiences and seeing how people can contribute to the section and how they contribute to life, to everything. And so I've learned it's a lot more about encouraging and more steering people in the right direction. Instead of being a hard maze with concrete walls, it's much more about a stream that kind of goes. Because if you tell somebody what to do, they might do it the first couple times. And if they respect you, they'll keep doing it. But these are unique people with their own lived experience. And so what I found really worked is differing opinions and seeing how my opinions can fit in with them. And so I know this is a lot of hypothetical talk. One of the biggest things, for example, was working with our concertmaster, Kevin, for example, recently. A lot of it is like, he has a very unique leading style. How can I lead the cello section? How can I show what he wants to do when we have something together and we're the secondary line? How can I show that everybody in my section will understand that while also not detracting from theirs? And so a lot of it is encouraging people's whose strengths I admire. So if somebody has a really beautiful sound, I'll say, you know, let's really support the section with the sound. If somebody has a really great sense of phrasing, I'll say, you know, let's lead this section with your sense of phrasing kind of thing. And obviously, like, deferring your leadership is not always the way to do it. But what I found, especially with our section, an incredibly young section who they're still learning how to play an orchestra as well. I found this to have a lot of success and we're still working on sound and everything, but it's one of those where now everybody has a bit of leadership within them. And I'm just the one who's sitting in front, pulling the little puppet strings, but not telling them what to do, more encouraging them, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And so how many new cellists have you hired since you became principal?
So I'm the longest serving cellist now. We have a completely new section. Yeah. So when I first joined, we hired a third chair cellist, fantastic cellist. She's now doing a new position in San Francisco Opera. So also, we don't have her. So now we have, let's see, six new cellists. We just hired a 1 year yesterday. So a really fantastic cellist from IU. But I would say we have one person who's older than me. Everybody else is younger than me. And the one person who's older than me, he played in a lot of the touring Broadway shows. And he has a lot of fantastic experience and a lot of that musical stability, I guess is a good way to put it, where I never have to worry about, because he has this kind of sense of this is how we play an orchestra kind of thing. Because when you play in a pit, a lot of it is like, there's no room for personal interpretation. You just do what you're told. Yeah. And I found that translates really well. And so it helps stabilize a lot of the people who have never really had a job before. And this is their first learning experience. So yeah, just knowing who you can lean on for help with that as well.
What an amazing difference, though, to go from a section where everybody is close to retirement and then have it completely turn over to where you, still probably being one of the younger people in the orchestra, have a section that's now younger than you.
Exactly. It's fantastic for me because it keeps me in shape. We do a lot of cello ensemble stuff, and there'll be somebody who has a solo. I was like, damn, that sounds really good. I need to go practice. Just little stuff like that where it's inspiring to be in that section. And I'm really excited to see what the future holds for the section because it's really fantastic. All the personalities are very different, but they're all great personalities. We haven't really had any issues so far. So yeah, it's great. Yeah.
Well, what advice would you offer to those musicians wanting to pursue a similar path to you?
I would say the biggest one is to find what makes you unique. I mean, we had an audition day from hell yesterday where we had 49 people in a prelim round that had to be done by 4, then an A-person semifinal, then a 2-person final. So we were there from 9 a.m. until 7:30 p.m.
Yikes.
I do not advocate for that at all. It was just because we had way more people than we thought. So for example, when you listen to 49 of the same 3 excerpts in concerto, the people that stand out, for example, are the people where they have cultivated a gorgeous sound and a gorgeous sense of phrasing. What I've learned is that especially with modern auditions, most people have access to online materials, to teachers who they know how to play excerpts now, which is honestly a very scary thing. Because before I started auditioning, it seemed like if you knew how to do these certain things in excerpts, it's hidden code kind of thing. Like, I know how to play an orchestra. But now everybody plays so well that the people who stand out are the people that go above and beyond and make their personal voice, that basically make an argument for why we should include their personal voice in an orchestra like ours. And so the people who stand out, like I said, are the people with the sound that is most unique to them while still being gorgeous and being able to fit in, and also a sense of long phrasing, because those are the two hardest things that there are to teach, because it's such a personal thing. It's like saying to somebody, can you change how you talk? It's hard to do because it's like an integral sense, especially I've played since I was 4. So it's 25 years of this is my sound kind of thing. And so I remember when I was in college, I got super into the recordings of these older school cellos like Leonard Rose, Feuermann, Piatigorsky, the kind of old classy sounds that also I felt that my teacher, Mr. Leonard, is like the newer version of that in terms of what he teaches, everything being classy, everything being relaxed and elegant, while still having, like, when you need that gut, you have guts there as well. And so I would say the biggest thing that helped me is just finding what you're good at and really nailing that home. It's kind of what I was saying about like finishing the ISO audition with Shasti 15. That was one of my strong excerpts. And when you're doing excerpts, it's one of those where instead of thinking, every excerpt is a 7 out of 10, I have to make them all 9 out of 10s. Obviously, you have to have all excerpts at a certain level. But instead of, let's say I have all of them at 7 out of 10 and a couple are at 8 out of 10, but those 8 out of 10s, I feel really great. These are my strong excerpts. These are what showcase my sound, for example. I was talking to a friend who's now the assistant principal trombone of San Francisco, Nick Platoff. And the way that he described it was, you have to make those excerpts 11 out of 10. Don't focus on the excerpt. Obviously, again, there has to be a baseline, but don't focus on bringing every excerpt up to that level. Obviously, do it to a certain amount, but really focus on the ones that you're strongest, because I found this to be true as well. The people who stand out the most aren't like, oh, they played everything so clean and so well, and such a great sound thing. It was like, holy crap, did you hear that Don Quixote? Did you hear that finale? Did you hear that sound that they got? It's always this one thing that their strengths really speak to you as a committee. That and seeking out the right people to help you on this journey. Like I said, I started studying with somebody when I was 14, and immediately I was like, I want to be just like you. I knew that he was a fantastic teacher, but also one of the greatest people that I know in terms of just personality wise, generosity of spirit. And so find somebody like that if you can, a role model that can help guide you. Eric is also an absolutely fantastic resource as well. And he's very much like that as well. So I'm really lucky that I've had really all my teachers have led me in this direction and showed me what orchestra life, especially orchestra principal life, could be. And that's the thing that lit the fire under me to want to do that and also to maybe in the future even accomplish more. So,
yeah, I mean, and Eric's example too of playing as such a prestigious principal, but then transitioning, like you were talking about, to being one of the most sought after teachers also. So
exactly.
It's really
exactly,
great. Yeah. Well, this has been a great conversation. So thank you so much for joining us today on the Cello Sherpa podcast.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you so much to Austin Huntington for joining us today and sharing his story with us. And thank you for listening to another episode of the Cello Sherpa podcast. For more information on Austin and any of the links we spoke about today, check out our show notes by scrolling down on the episode. Be sure and catch our next episode where we interview cellist Myron Lutsky, who is the principal cellist of New York's Orchestra of St. Luke's and the American Classical Orchestra. We talk about his teaching philosophy, his expertise in performing early music, what the life of a highly sought-after New York freelancer is like, and much more. We're here to serve you, so if you have questions or topic suggestions you would like us to cover in future episodes, please use the contact page on our website, thecellosherpa.com. You will also find information about the specific services we offer on the website. Don't forget to follow us and rate us on whatever platform you get your podcasts. This helps us climb the rankings so other people can find us. Today's episode was edited by Eric Begay at Red House Productions and produced and recorded by me, Joel Dallow.